This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have with us Simon Schofield as a professor of teaching fellowship at the University of Otago Law School, and he has had experience with employment advice, mostly, I think, from the employer's standpoint, according to the university. And we've got Corey Bourne from the CTU as an advisor on health and safety. And you can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Well, welcome, Simon and Corey, to Community or Chaos. Hopefully more community and less chaos. How are you? Well, I think I'll start out with a question for Corey first. Could you talk about the history of health and safety regimes in New Zealand between the second half of the 20th century and November 20th, 2010?
Well, kia ora, Marvin. Thanks for having us on. So New Zealand's health and safety regime in the second half of the 20th century, we've done a little bit of research for coming on, saw that it was very broad and very ad hoc. Saw a stat here by 1980, New Zealand's occupational health and safety legislation covered by 31 different pieces of legislation, supported by some 100 plus regulations and approved codes of practice, and administered by 5 different government bodies. So it was a situation where certain workplaces were covered by bespoke pieces of legislation, others not. So very ad hoc in its approach. If we go over to the UK in the 70s, there was a big change there. So they had a number of industrial issues, workplace fatalities, and they commissioned a review into health and safety through Lord Alfred Robins. So he was a trade unionist and a head of the National Coal Board in the UK, and he took a review of their system, in which they found that they needed to simplify the laws and leave the duties of health and safety to those that are creating them, the businesses, but making sure the workers are involved in the processes around workplace health and safety, but also that it was overseen by a strong and capable regulator. So New Zealand, obviously, we were opposite of that through the 80s and to the 90s. We're in 92. We had a new piece of leg come in, Health and Safety Act 1992, which I guess tried to move towards that UK model, but given the political environment at the time, we weren't so committed. The role of the state greatly reduced, so that strong and capable regulator wasn't brought in as much, and the self-regulation of the 90s meant that we were leaving it to workplaces, but it did try and codify all those leg into one in New Zealand. But as I say, the commitment to that Robin-style tripartite model wasn't there. And then through the 2000s, there are a couple of amendments that strengthened some of the participation practices in health and safety. And then your end date of 2010 obviously was a big catalyst of health and safety with the Pike River mine. So a very quick overshoot of the regulatory regime.
Simon, would you have anything to add to that, or would you like to talk about the changes?
So we definitely went from a very prescriptive model during the later part of the 20th century to a very principles-based model with the Robbins or the Robbins model. And so that is enshrined in the Health and Safety and Employment Act 1992. But as we've seen, no doubt we'll get onto this, that it is the way in which we have worked has changed. And so health and safety in employment was no longer sufficient to deal with the issues that society was facing come 2010.
All right. Corey, would you talk about the Pike River mine explosion on the 19th of November 2010, which killed 29 workers? Very briefly, what happened and what led up to the disaster?
Cool. So very briefly, that was the Pike River mine explosion on the, as you say, the 19th of November, which killed 29 workers. There were 29 men underground who died either immediately or shortly afterwards from the explosion in the mine or from the toxic atmosphere that was left behind. We know over the next 9 days that the mine exploded another three times before it was sealed. And then following that, we had two critical reviews. So one was the Royal Commission into the Pike River mine that focused on the issues that led to that disaster. And the other was the Independent Task Force review, which was reviewing the New Zealand health and safety system more broadly. Some of the key factors that led to the Pike explosion was a board of directors, a governance of the Pike River Mine Company that didn't have a great deal of interest in the health and safety system of the business. We know from the review there that a number of issues were raised through the workers up the chain through up until the day of the explosion. There were numerous warnings of methane, excessive methane, and to a point where it was explosive. Where's my little stat? In the 48 days before the explosion, 21 reports of methane levels reaching explosive volumes and 27 reports of lesser but still dangerous volumes of methane. Poor worker engagement, poor health and safety practices, and another key finding being the regulator, the Department of Labor, who was the regulator at the time, didn't have the focus, capacity, or strategies to ensure that Pike was meeting its duties. I know from the report as well that the drive to mine the coal had the blinders on, so that other operational activities such as the health and safety compliance and systems took a bit of a back seat to that drive. And Simon, if you want to add anything, feel free to jump in.
Just that. Some of the way, as you say, some of the way in which Pike River was set up was very much focused on making money. So that fed through to the workers. For instance, they had bonuses in which incentivized them essentially not to report health and safety because then they'd get more money by working in the mine. So that's not very helpful in ensuring best health and safety practices. And it doesn't also, the point that Corey made, that we've got an underfunded regulator that doesn't have the technical expertise that's necessary to deal with these situations. Mining is a very complex industry. And so having a regulator that's able to understand that industry is vitally important. Instead, we've got, as was shown on TV at the time. It was the police fronting it, which shows the real challenge of health and safety in that industry.
So in a way, that what happened in Pike River was a sign of the times when you talk about the importance of making a profit first. Is this still, that would still be the case in a lot of industries, wouldn't it?
It's challenging. I'll let Corey talk to this. Certainly there were lessons learned from Pike River, but I'm not sure all of the lessons have fallen on deaf ears. A lot of people have isolated and said that's a discrete disaster, and we don't mine like that anymore, and therefore we don't need to deal with those issues in the same way. And so that's the real problem, is that we haven't learned from Pike River at all.
Corey?
Yeah, there's definitely a New Zealand cultural element to this as well, of, as you say, trying to make a profit, but we need to make sure that good health and safety practices are good as a part of doing business. It's not not an additional cost. It's just something that needs to be done. So there's a lot of culture shift in that space that still exists. So, you know, good businesses know that health and safety is a part of productivity. It's a part of doing business well. And then obviously there's going to be others that still, you know, see it through that guise of red tape and additional costs. It's about having a system that leads that step change towards good health and safety.
When you listen to political statements recently about profitability and efficiency, you get the sense that there's still quite a strong trend to put making a profit first before the environment, before health and safety.
Yeah, I disagree. And as I was saying, you got to understand that having injured or killed workers is going to be bad for productivity. They're the ones doing the work. They're the ones that are creating that productivity. So health and safety needs to be a part and parcel of good work.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that in order to do business, you need to adhere to these requirements, because without those workers, you can have all the efficiency you like, but that you're externalizing those costs onto the workers, and that's what the real danger is. So the profits are being going in one direction, but the costs to society are going in another direction. So that's something to be really conscious of in this space. I would say also that Pike River was a wake-up call, in the sense that there is perhaps now more than there was then a bigger health and safety industry, consultants and the like, who are able to advise on a lot of these issues. And in many ways, that's reassuring. So the private sector has stepped up their game in showing that, you know, this is part of doing business. If you want to do business in New Zealand, then this is how we do it.
Has there been an increase or a decrease in fatalities in forestry and mining and other heavy industry in New Zealand in the last 20 years or so?
Have you got the data, Simon?
I do not have the data. What my broad observation would be is that it is generally declining, but I say that with a lot of caution, because yes, it's declining, but and that's for a variety of reasons, but it's not declining nearly fast enough. And so when you compare us with Australia, you compare us with the UK, we're just nowhere near where we need to be. In the industries, say, forestry is a really good example. There used to be, and there still is, a lot of deaths of young, untrained workers. And That has been slowly decreasing because of changes in technology. So you'll see often on the forestry sites a greater use of machines, but they themselves, of course, come with risk. So you're replacing one risk with another risk, perhaps a lot slightly lower risk, but nevertheless still a risk. So although it's trending downwards, that's no reason for complacency at all.
Don't we still have almost twice as many fatalities as Australia or UK?
That's right. I think the UK is a difficult one.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so we've got a primarily agricultural-based economy. I say that with a caution. And that inevitably leads to higher risk of injuries and death. And so Australia is definitely a better comparator than the UK, which is focused, certainly in the UK, they're focused on it being a service-based economy. And so we don't fill that gap yet. We're not quite there. So we've still got that agrarian economy, which inevitably leads to higher health and safety risks.
Well, there isn't any reason why it should be as high as it is, or shouldn't it be closer to what Australia's facility?
Correct.
And the other part of it, Marvin, is the workplace deaths attributable to things like disease and for the consequences of work. So you've got your workplace fatalities dying on the job. You have one almost one a week, I think the data is at the moment. And as Simon says, it's not coming down fast enough. But then there's another every year 750 to 900 conservative estimates of people dying from things like asbestosis and cancers that are attributable to work. And those numbers need to be addressed. They're not coming down nearly fast enough. They're pretty much stagnant.
Do the unions, particularly in fields like forestry and mining, do the workers themselves are they required to have a say in the safety regulations? I know at one time that in mining there was a strong union activity as far as safety, and then that you see decreases to some extent in the 90s.
Yeah, so in our current legislation, the Health and Safety at Work Act 2015, there is a legal requirement to engage workers when on anything that's going to impact workplace health and safety. And so that duty exists, and there is it is a requirement of businesses to engage the workers. I guess the element is that in reality, it can be hard to have that enforced, especially when we've got a regulator that's already being stretched so thin. That it can be really hard to have those worker engagement duties enforced by the regulator. So in theory, yes, in practice, a bit harder.
Is it also part of the
But I'll just
problem?
add something to that.
Yeah.
One of the things with Australia is they have a large resourced body. So Safe Work Australia is well resourced, and so it's able to bring prosecutions that our WorkSafe just simply doesn't have the resources to prosecute. And aligned with that is the greater role of unions in Australia, certainly in the mining space. Whereas in New Zealand, because of challenges in terms of geography, there just isn't the same union presence in those industries compared to Australia, that is.
Unions themselves since the 1990s have not been as strong, have they?
It's funny, right? We have I don't have the stats in front of me, but I think we have a denser population union population than Australia does, but their commitment to the union engagement and the worker participation and their regulations is stronger. So they have a more enforced presence over there.
So you'd
And
say
as
that
Simon points out, we've got different densities and across different unions across the two countries.
one of the weaknesses is that the enforcement agencies in New Zealand are under strength, would you say?
Yeah. Yeah. The It's a big job they've got, and they can't be everywhere, but it's made harder by not having enough resource to cover.
Are they underfunded?
I would add that some of the stuff is really complex. When we're talking about asbestos, when we're talking about mining, and we're talking about forestry, the accident investigations are very complex, and you need skilled people to undertake those investigations. And New Zealand's what got 5-6 million. We just don't have the resources that other countries, including Australia, have, and that feeds into we expect, say, WorkSafe, which is just a body that's covering everything, to deal with this. And they're having to deal with everything from gases to falls from scaffolding, and so that is a real strain on resources.
If they had more funding, could they get people trained in Australia, for instance?
They do. But again, that comes down to funding, and there's just not the appetite at the moment for that. But I acknowledge that's a problem.
Well, how do you see the? I understand the government's proposing changes to health and safety. Can you talk about that? I know that we don't know exactly what they are, but what's proposed?
They have suggested a series of streamlining reforms. There has been calls from the industry for greater regulation in health and safety. If you look at Australia, they are far more comprehensive. To be honest, I don't see why we can't just co-opt what Australia has on many of these issues.
Mm.
But for whatever reason, that hasn't been taken up. And we insist on going through each document with a fine-tooth comb to ensure that it meets New Zealand conditions. And we see that famously with the minister announcing reform of children picking up eggs on farms. And I think that sort of the idea there, that certainly the minister's idea, was to show the stupidity of the regulation, that it can be, it can be over regulation. But the challenge there, of course, is under regulation. So it's all very well to talk about kids getting eggs, but if those kids have to cross a dam to get it, go through water, or they have to go on a motorbike to get there, then you've just changed that whole health and safety risk in that space. And so it's not simple, and these issues need to be worked through. Mm. And I'm not sure, to be honest, that they are being worked through with sufficient rigor.
And Corey, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, so I think that if we reflect back on those reports that came out following the Pike, the reviews into Pike and the Royal Commission, that set out the blueprint for where New Zealand needed to focus its attention to really improve its health and safety game. I think the announced reforms to be confirmed, a lot of them go antithesis to a lot of those recommendations. So things like the importance of business governance and health and safety. One of the proposed reforms is to split that from the operational governance, and that was a big key factor into Pike, right? Was the people on the board not prioritizing health and safety, and then that culture going through the business. You've got other ones around the confusing nature of regulation. We still have an unfinished suite of regulation in New Zealand, as Simon's pointed out. We should just be stealing some of that and applying it, but all that work's been paused the points around having a weak regulator that leading into the pike conditions. I think from our perspective, we're seeing a bit of a return to that with the mandate and resource being pulled back from WorkSafe. So that consensus of what we needed to do post-pike, which I think still exists, the unions, the some of the business forums, the health and safety professionals, they still agree that that's the way to go. And unfortunately, the minister isn't in agreement with the rest of us and is pursuing some of these goals through their reforms.
I understand that this is where it gets complicated. The ACC has had a lot to do with injury prevention or making it at least publicizing an education for injury. And they have planned now on to deprioritize injury prevention. Any comments on that? Am I misled?
To be honest, I wouldn't have thought that would have cost that much. So there's definitely things, for instance, that WorkSafe can do, that ACC can do, which don't cost a lot of money, but which have a greater purpose. And in the health and safety space, for instance, improvement notices or infringement fines, if they were used more aggressively by the regulator, that would get the message to businesses quicker, and because it's much like a speeding fine. After you've had your first speeding fine, you're like watching your speed ridiculously, aren't you? And so I think that our approach is, well, we don't want to be seen to be nasty. We want to be seen as an educator. But the fact is, if we do have those small sanctions, then perhaps we can avoid some of the big litigation, which costs far more. So if we can use those tools more effectively, that would be better. And so ACC has a role to play here, and they certainly engage with businesses, certainly from an occupational therapy perspective, to try to prevent injuries. And because they're a state, well, effectively the state, they're listened to by businesses. And so they often take what ACC says on board and therefore incorporate that, which can be challenging at times for a union, say in a collective bargaining environment where everyone's wanting wage increases, that having ACC there pushing these changes is an important part of the framework we have.
It's important that these all the parts of the system are cohesive and pushing towards the same goal. As we've spoken to earlier today, the problem's not getting smaller at a fast enough click, and having our key government departments, WorkSafe, ACC, all pulling back is going to leave gaps in the system that we need to all be working towards as a collective, as the key stakeholders, the government, the workers, the professionals and the businesses. We all need to be on the same wavelength.
Yeah, and the challenge with them pulling back is that those people get left behind, right? So you're going to have those workers who are injured that aren't able to just walk into another job, yet they get pushed around a bit, right? Because ACC wants them off their books, so they don't want to take responsibility for them. The business is like, well, we can't have that person in our business anymore. It's like, well, how do we get that person back to work? And often in this fiscal environment, that is pushed back onto the worker. Those and when you're applying for, you know, 100, 1,000 jobs, and you're disabled because you've got an injury, it's really, really tough.
Do you think the public is still, right after Pike River, I think the public was very aware of work safety. Is that still the case? Have we kept up our awareness of work safety?
It's funny, right? You've got hysteria around road cones and things. There's a bit of a distraction. And some people, that rhetoric around health and safety being red tape or just common sense. But then those same people, everyone knows someone that's been injured or hurt at work, and the big toll that has on people's lives and communities. So when you kind of get below that surface level discussion, I do think there is better understanding around the importance of workplace health and safety when you get down to the key issues, which is making sure everyone gets home healthy and safe from work every day.
Certainly in the space that I am, in the education sector, my answer would be, as part of your commerce degree, because these are the people that are going into being directors and working for businesses, as part of management, health and safety needs to be at the forefront. And if we can educate people going into those industries of the importance of health and safety at that front end, then we don't get a situation where our directors and managers are not treating health and safety seriously. And so one advantage of, say, the litigation in, say, Maritime and Gibson, so this is Tony Gibson, who was CEO at Ports of Auckland, had been prosecuted personally in respect of his role. One advantage of that individual accountability is it really makes those directors, managers, CEOs, CFOs really think about the decisions that they're making and the impact that they're having. They can't say, oh, well, we've had previous deaths in this organisation. That was before my time. I don't need to pay any attention to that moving forward. Well, actually, the way in which this 2015 Act works is to ensure that everyone in that organisation has a role to play in protecting health and safety. And it's not just the worker. Yes, the worker has a role to play in relation to health and safety, but so do those middle managers, so does the CEO, so do those directors, so do the consultants that are advising in relation to that, as well as all the other companies or organisations that are working in that industry. Mm. So the way in which the 2015 Act works is sort of, I would say, a fishing net. It tries to capture everyone to the best it can. And that has an advantage in the sense that everyone's now accountable. It has the disadvantage is that WorkSafe's resources are really stretched. And so it needs to be thinking carefully in terms of targeting the various issues, and that can be done in a variety of ways.
Does work and safety, don't they face some of the same problems that the public health faces? Basically, that this country has trouble financing our social infrastructure, partially because of our reluctance to use taxation effectively, and partially because of the size of the country and location. But are they facing some of the same problems that public health faces? Just it's under-resourced, and it's hard to change that.
Yeah, and it forces the country to be in a more reactive space. We're reacting to things after they've happened. And obviously, if you've got the resource, you want to put those barriers at the top of the cliff rather than sending ambulances to the bottom.
There's lots of things that could be done, but that won't because of the political climate. For instance, WorkSafe could change the legislation to make the defendants pay for the cost of the prosecution, right? So currently we essentially subsidise the prosecution by WorkSafe in our general taxes. And so it's the general taxes that pay for WorkSafe. But if WorkSafe had more of an incentive to get more money out of the defendants because of those breaches of the Health and Safety Act, then that doesn't need to come from general taxation. Of course, there's a reluctance to do that because your primary defendant is going to be a business, and we don't want to unfairly impinge across them. But you say that if the worker brought the case, say they're still alive, then that would be, they would be required to pay a greater share of the employee advocate or representative's costs in the Employment Relations Authority and Employment Court. But when you're going down the Health and Safety at Work Act, the way in which that system works is that essentially there's this large cost of prosecution and the WorkSafe only get a fraction of that back.
Are there people...
So my point is that there's solutions here, but people may not like them.
Are there organizations besides unions that are working on actually promoting some of the suggestions that you both have made? Is this... For instance, some of the information I got was from a website called Public Health and Communications Center, ATRO.
So there is a number, I'll let Corey talk to this in probably more detail, but the private sector health and safety consultants is a large industry, and they have been doing quite a bit of legwork in terms of saying, some of the minister's ideas are challenging and don't necessarily understand the space. And so certainly those health and safety consultants in the private sector are leading the charge here, but the unions have a role to play here as well as the state in terms of ACC and WorkSafe.
Obviously you've got the union voice there representing the workers. You have groups, the health and safety professionals that Simon's alluded to, that have their expert knowledge, so they're on the ground as well, seeing it firsthand from a bit of a secondhand view as well. You've got other industry bodies, so certain sectors set up groups that ideally tripartite, they've got business and worker voice on them and they can represent sectors. You've got ones across construction and other sectors like that. And you've got other groups like the one you mentioned, the PHCC and other occupational public health groups that are advocating for better in their spheres of influence for where they cover across the medical profession. And Marvin, I might have to jump off. I've got another engagement, but thanks for having me on, and thanks for having the conversation.
Thanks, Corey. We'll continue, and thanks a lot for your participation.
And thanks, Simon. It was a good chat.
Thank you.
Simon, before we go on to mediation and so on, would you have anything more you'd like to say generally about health and safety?
I think we're in a difficult time at the moment in terms of the statutory framework, but in terms of the need for greater regulation in certain specific areas. And we need to be alive to that. So I think that education is an important part of the solution here.
You think part of the problem is that we've got a general, I think in the English-speaking world, we've got a We think short term.
Yeah, there's another, there's some related issues, right? So once someone has died, we tend to treat that as an isolated event. And so we don't have the incentives to prevent people from dying in the same way that other countries do. Because of the no-fault system of ACC, and it is a great system, but it sort of supports this she'll be right attitude, which means that there's not that accountability that there should be.
Well, it seems to me that both in the organization of industry, but also things like asbestos and other things that have to do with health, you have to actually, you've got to look beyond the next dividend. You've got to look beyond 2 or 3 years, don't you?
Yeah. Now, that's a fundamental problem for this country. Yeah. And I don't have the solution for you, but definitely the profile of health and safety has been raised, but I think it needs to continue to be folded into the way in which we do business in this country.
Since the Employment Contracts Act in 1991, union coverage has fallen sharply. About 14% of workers are represented by unions, and they tend to be in the public service sector. So where do workers go for help when not covered by union membership, and they face either they feel they face harassment or they get dismissed and feel the dismissal's been unjustified?
So there are a few options. Obviously, going to a union or a union representative in those circumstances is an option. But for some areas of the country, the union density is just not there. And so often what fills the gap is lay advocates as well as lawyers. And so lawyers aren't cheap. And so that means that a worker who has lost their job, doesn't have any money coming in, is often forced into a situation where they need to go to a lay advocate to pursue a personal grievance, often against their employer. And during as a result of raising that personal grievance, they'll often go to mediation and then the Employment Relations Authority and, if necessary, to the Employment Court.
Can you tell me about the lay advocates?
Yeah. So there's a number of challenges with lay advocates, and partially that is fed by a lack of education. You have to think about why we have lawyers to begin with. Why can't we just have anybody turning up to court and arguing the case? And in fact, the courts are increasingly being filled with people that are self-representative. So they're arguing their own case in front of an authority member or a judge. Now, lay advocates have the advantage of knowing what works and what doesn't, and has that ability to present the case. So a good lay advocate, as the case law has suggested, is as good as a good lawyer. The challenge is, of course, that there's no regulation of lay advocates at all, certainly at a formal level. And so some lay advocates who don't have legal training often fall into the trap of taking on their client's case and getting very personally involved with the attendant consequences to that. It's definitely something that the industry has called for in terms of the regulation of advocates, that there's something needs to be done. But neither the left or the right form of government has so far been successful in getting past this need for regulation. They just haven't been able to. They've had other priorities on their plate, and so haven't addressed it. And so it goes on, and that it causes a lot of angst for both employees and employers. And often the Employment Relations Authority and the Employment Court are the ones that are effectively having to have craft orders in order to do things that a lawyer would ordinarily do or ordinarily wouldn't do. And so that's the way in which they're being informally regulated, i.e. the employment institutions themselves are having to pull finger.
Do many workers, particularly middle management, go to their employer and the employer then sets up mediation? And how can you tell if the mediation is going to be objective and neutral?
Yeah. So the first thing I probably should have cautioned that statement earlier. So the first thing anybody in a workplace dispute should do is talk to their employer, or vice versa. If you're an employer, just talk to the employee to try to resolve the concerns. But that's not always possible, right? And so that's when external help can assist. But the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment run the mediation service under the Employment Relations Act. And they provide a brilliant service across the country to help people resolve employment relationship problems. And that can be a benefit to both the employer and the employee. Mediation is intrinsically part of the way in which the employment relations framework has been set up in this country. And I often find, even though it's in a confidential setting, you can resolve things with an apology. That perhaps you couldn't do in open correspondence, i.e. letters between the parties or emails or the like. So I think mediation has a role to play here. It's not the be-all and end-all, and certainly not all matters resolve, although most matters are settled at mediation and go no further.
What do you think of the non-disclosure contracts that people often sign, particularly after?
This is a challenging issue, but the general rule is that the nature of mediation and the nature of those agreements is that you'll often sign that everything that's said was confidential and you're not to talk about the dispute. Employees and employers should actually think very carefully about whether they want to sign those. It is perfectly lawful for the parties not to sign that and to have an agreement that both parties can openly discuss. And in fact, often this takes the place of saying an announcement that a person has resigned and that they're off to a new job or whatever, that can be used in a way to appease the situation. The reason why non-disclosure is so common is that often the employees will be seeking money and the employer doesn't want to disclose the sum that they had paid. But of course, the confidentiality provision itself can be drafted in such a way that it only applies in respect of the sum of money and not to, say, that employee's work ethic or something like that.
The I understand that some disclosure, non-disclosure contracts actually say that you can't even talk about it to your counselor. That'd be fairly rare. It would happen.
There's all sorts of I would say dodgy parts to non-disclosure agreements, and some of them are fairly aggressive in the way in which they fairly aggressive in the requirement in respect of confidentiality. So my suggestion is that any employee that signs one of these non-disclosure agreements gets independent advice as to its meaning and effect. Because while a non-disclosure agreement doesn't stop you going to the police or going to a professional body or the like, the reality is that that is going to cause a number of issues because that employment relationship problem hasn't been solved. So my suggestion often is to do any of, if you're going to make those disclosures to the police or to the professional bodies, that is done prior to signing one of these non-disclosure agreements and in full and with the full knowledge of the other side of what's happening, because that guarantees it guarantees avoiding an argument about whether or not the non-disclosure agreement covers what has been discussed subsequently.
Aren't many of the people who are in a situation like this at a disadvantage, or at least feel it, or are actually at a they're dealing with a large employer. They hope, if they're losing their job, they hope to get some kind of financial help. And they might feel like they have to sign this. They may not have to sign it, but they may feel like they have to sign it.
It's actually, there's currently a bill going through Parliament in respect of pre-negotiation, pre-termination negotiations, which allows an employer to have settlement discussions about ending an employment relationship for a sum of money. This would only encourage that sort of behaviour. What I would advise any employee in that situation is to get independent advice, go to a lawyer, go to a lay advocate, because then you'll be in a more sure footing of what's occurring, and then you can appreciate what you're signing, so that you don't get in a situation where you say that your boss is a prick. You say that after signing one of these, and of course that would maybe, depending on the wording of the settlement agreement, a breach of the confidentiality provisions. So I think the point is tread carefully and don't sign anything unless you've got independent advice.
We have
worst case scenario, that can be, you know, a family member, a friend who provides that support, so that you don't feel pressured in those situations.
Okay, what do you hope for in the way of changes in the future as far as health and safety, and also people who feel like they have lost their job in an unfair way. How do you see the future?
It's a big pie in the sky question, and I'm not sure I have all the answers. I do worry about some of the changes in the current Employment Relations Amendment Bill in respect of Uber drivers. I think that for some people that's going to be fine and not a problem. For others, it is going to be a problem. I do worry about the changes to the rules relating to contribution because so that means that employees who have been dismissed unjustifiably may not be entitled to any remedies, looking at their conduct holistically. There's a real challenge there when there's such a low threshold for serious misconduct. So I imagine the courts are going to have something to say on that. The high income threshold is what it is, but I imagine a mountain of litigation that's going to arise as a result of that change. What else is there?
Well, thanks a lot for coming on, Simon. I have run out of time.
It's all right.
I really appreciate what you've had to say, and we'll talk again.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye. We've been talking about employment and safety.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.